Welcome to the Deep Dive. The title of our deep dive is The Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor. Today, we're really digging into the October 22nd edition. And what just jumps out, I think, is this theme of scale, this struggle to manage sheer size.
Yeah, definitely.
We're seeing it everywhere from massive corporate deals and these, frankly, mind-boggling tech ambitions.
Billion-dollar visions.
Exactly, right down to global political chess games and even how all that filters into personal finance and, you know, cultural anxieties.
It's a great way to frame it. The sources really paint a picture of this relentless drive for consolidation, for just bigness, mm-hmm. whether it's media companies, AI startups, or entire nations. Everyone seems desperate for more influence, more capacity, more dominance.
Right. So our mission for you, the learner, is to unpack the most critical stuff, the surprising nuggets from today's news.
Yeah.
We want to give you the context, you know, help you understand the big strategic forces at play.
Not just what happened, but why it matters.
Precisely. So let's jump right in. Maybe starting with where finance and entertainment are colliding.
Sounds good. The media world right now. Wow. It feels like a giant game of Monopoly. But,
yeah.
you know, with unlimited credit lines, this Warner Bros. Discovery and Paramount situation is pretty wild.
It really is. It feels less like a desired merger and more like an acquisition dance driven by necessity.
Right.
WBD's CEO, David Zaslav, he's apparently fighting tooth and nail to keep the company independent. But the reality is they just announced this big strategic review.
Exploring a sale.
Yeah, exploring a sale of all or some parts of the company. And that came after getting multiple unsolicited offers. So, you know, the writing's kind of on the wall.
Merge or get left behind.
Basically. And you saw the market react instantly. WBD shares shot up 11% to over $20.
Investors liked the sound of consolidation.
They did. But Paramount, the main suitor right now, their stock actually dropped 3%.
Interesting. So the market thinks WBD has the better hand here.
It suggests that, yeah. Paramount, which, let's not forget, is backed by David Ellison and his father, Larry Ellison's, you know, immense wealth.
Right, Oracle money.
Exactly. They're clearly attracted by WBD's stronger assets, particularly the studio's Warner Bros. Has had some big hits recently, like Sinners, Weapons.
And the streaming business is much bigger, too, right?
Way bigger. That's the key. WBD's got nearly 126 million streaming subscribers globally. Paramount Plus is sitting at, what, about 77.7 million?
That's a huge difference. Merging them creates a real giant.
Instantly. A true competitor to Netflix and Disney on a global scale.
But Zaslav, you said he doesn't want to be acquired. He has his own plan.
Apparently so. He seems to favor an internal split. The idea is to break WBD into two public companies.
How would that work?
One would hold the high growth, high value stuff, the studios, HBO
yeah.
Max. The other would basically contain the cable networks like CNN, which are, you know, declining and carry more liabilities.
Huh. So splitting off the weaker parts before a potential sale.
It looks like a defensive move, yeah. And maybe a way to maximize the value of the crown jewels. If you spin off the cable side, you get rid of that declining revenue, those legacy issues.
And the remaining company, just studio and streaming, becomes a much cleaner target.
Much cleaner, much more attractive, especially for, say, a big tech company that just wants the content library and the global streaming platform, not the old cable infrastructure.
That makes a lot of sense. Preparing the best bits for the market. And now that the news is out, the usual suspects are circling.
Oh, yeah. Analysts expect everyone to kick the tires, as they say. Amazon, Comcast, which owns NBC Universal, Netflix, Apple. They'll all likely take a look.
It just confirms that premium content is still king, even for the tech giants.
Absolutely. Even Netflix. Their co-CEO, Ted Sarando, said, you know, nothing is a must-have for us. But he also said they look at all M&A opportunities. So if that WBD library comes into play.
Even they can't ignore it. An analyst called it a come one, come all situation.
That sums it up pretty well. The scale is just too big to ignore.
Okay, from fighting for scale in Hollywood to, well, a scale of financial ambition that is just, frankly, staggering. The AI sector. OpenAI. Sam Altman.
Staggering is the right word. Altman's on this massive deal-making blitz, as the journal calls it, trying to lock down what he terms seemingly endless computing power.
And he's doing it by playing the tech giants off each other.
Essentially, yes. Leveraging their egos, their FOMO. The long-term vision is, well, it's immense.
Give us the numbers. What's the goal?
The goal is 250 gigawatts of computing capacity by 2033.
Okay. What does that mean in dollars?
to build that out today, over $10 trillion.
$10 trillion with a T.
Yes. I mean, think about that. That's roughly the combined annual GDP of Japan and Germany for computing power.
That's building a new kind of nation state based on compute.
It's that scale. And here's the kicker. OpenAI, the company driving this need, is projected to generate maybe $13 billion in revenue this year.
$13 billion versus $10 trillion. That's not just a gap. That's a canyon. How on earth do they plan to pay for it?
Well, they can't. Not based on current revenue. That's the whole point of the Blitz. They're signing up for these astronomical future bills, like $650 billion in commitments just from NVIDIA and Oracle alone. That number is probably closer to $1 trillion now with other deals.
So they lock in the future capacity now, creating this massive obligation.
And that massive obligation creates intense fear of missing out FOMO among all the potential suppliers. Chip makers, cloud providers.
They feel they have to be part of this, even if the economics look crazy right now.
Exactly. Because the potential future payoff, if Altman's vision of artificial general intelligence comes true, is just world-changing, and Microsoft learned this the hard way.
Right. OpenAI's main partner. What happened there?
Well, initially, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella was hesitant. Altman proposed this $100 billion data center project, codenamed Stargate. Nadella reportedly said, at some point, the supply and demand have to map. You know, basic financial sense.
Sounds reasonable.
It was. But then Oracle Larry Ellison, remember him from the Paramount bid? Oracle swooped in.
And signed a huge deal with OpenAI.
Right. A $300 billion contract. $300 billion.
Wow.
And Oracle's stock surged 40% on that news. It showed everyone, if you hesitate, your rivals will jump in.
So Nadella saw Oracle making this massive play.
And the FOMO kicked in hard. Microsoft immediately pivoted. They announced their own plan for the world's most powerful AI data center in Wisconsin, specifically for OpenAI. It was a clear counter move. We can do this too, faster, better.
It's like a global poker game with national energy grids as the chips.
What
about NVIDIA, the main chip supplier?
NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang, apparently felt a bit sidelined earlier this year when Altman and SoftBank were talking about Stargate. So Huang came back with a monster deal.
How big?
A $350 billion agreement to lease OpenAI up to 5 million of NVIDIA's top-end chips.
Mind-blowing numbers.
But here's the really critical part. NVIDIA is also discussing guaranteeing some of the loans OpenAI will need to take out to build its own data center.
Wait, NVIDIA might co-sign OpenAI's loans. They'd be on the hook if OpenAI can't pay.
That seems to be the discussion. It's an incredible level of financial risk for NVIDIA, but it shows how much Huang believes in this vision and how much he wants NVIDIA to be the absolute core supplier.
It ties NVIDIA's fate directly to OpenAI's success.
It does. And others are rushing in too, basically subsidizing OpenAI. AMD reportedly gave OpenAI up to 10% of its future stock just to get them to buy their new Instinct chips, which are still kind of unproven compared to NVIDIA's.
Giving away stock to secure a customer.
And Broadcom matched the size of the NVIDIA deal, 10 gigawatts of capacity pledged. Everyone wants a piece of this future, even if it means taking on enormous risk or offering massive discounts now.
It all seems to hinge on Altman's conviction. He famously said something like, "The most successful people believe in themselves almost to the point of delusion."
That quote's been going around, yeah. But think about the implications. You have the entire semiconductor industry, the cloud computing giants, potentially trillions in future investment, all getting tied to the success of this one startup.
A startup that's nowhere near generating the cash flow to support it all.
Exactly. It creates this too-big-to-fail scenario, but on a technological and infrastructural scale we've just never seen before. It's tying huge parts of the U.S. economy, the energy grid, chip manufacturing, to this single vision.
An unprecedented concentration of risk. Okay, let's shift slightly, but stick with finance. Some key quarterly earnings reports also tell a story about strategy right now.
Yeah, definitely. General Motors had a surprisingly strong Q3. Their stock had its best day in 5 years, jumped 15%.
Oh, my, the surge.
Well, their adjusted operating income was $3.4 billion, much better than the $2.7 billion analysts expected. But the strategy behind it is really interesting.
What are they doing?
They're actually hitting the brakes temporarily on their EV push. They announced a special charge for Q4 related to downsizing the unprofitable EV business. They're even stopping production of their electric commercial vans.
So pulling back from EVs. But isn't that the future?
It is long-term, but right now they're doubling down on what's making money. Gas-guzzling trucks and SUVs, demand is high, profits are high.
So it's a bet on
yeah.
What slower EV adoption. regulatory changes?
Probably a mix. The current administration has eased some clean vehicle rules, which gives them breathing room. So GM seems to be saying, let's make hay while the sun shines with gas vehicles, and we'll reinvest heavily in EVs when the market or the regulations force our hand more strongly.
A pragmatic, maybe cynical, short-term profit play.
You could see it that way. It definitely affects the timeline for U.S. auto electrification. Meanwhile, over in streaming, Netflix also had a strong quarter.
Revenue and profit up.
Yeah, revenue up 17% to $11.5 billion. But the growth isn't just coming from adding new subscribers anymore. That's slowing down.
So where's the growth coming from?
Two things. Price hikes, which they've been implementing, and advertising. This was reportedly their best quarter ever for ad sales. They're on track to more than double ad revenue this year.
So the ad-supported tier is really working for them.
It seems to be. It shows how embedded Netflix is. They can raise prices and successfully launch a major new revenue stream like advertising, all leveraging that massive user base.
And one more Coca-Cola. They also showed some strength.
They did. Sales and earnings were up. Revenue climbed 5% to about $12.5 billion. The interesting thing here is how...
Price increases,
yeah. But also what they called a better mix of products. Global volume for their core sodas was actually flat compared to last year.
So people aren't drinking more Coke?
Not necessarily more soda, but they might be buying more expensive versions, smaller packages perhaps, or shifting to Coke's other drinks. Volume for water, sports drinks, coffee, and tea grew 3%.
So they're using their brand power to push prices up and also guide consumers towards higher margin non-soda options.
Exactly. Leveraging that brand strength in an inflationary environment.
Okay, so we're seeing these massive financial forces shaping media, tech, autos, consumer goods. Let's see how this kind of economic leverage plays out on the world stage now. Geopolitics.
Right. And a classic example is playing out in Argentina right now. A real tussle for influence between the U.S. and China.
Argentina's in economic distress, and the U.S. is offering a lifeline.
A big one. The Trump administration is putting together a $40 billion package for President Javier Milei's government.
$40 billion? That's serious money. How does it break down?
It's apparently two parts. $20 billion as a currency swap that helps Argentina stabilize its finances internally, manage debts in pesos without defaulting immediately.
Okay. And the other $20 billion?
That's structured as a bank-led debt facility. It signals maybe a bit more long-term confidence, but it definitely comes with significant strings attached.
And those strings are about China?
Absolutely. U.S. officials are pushing Milei hard to limit China's footprint in Argentina.
What specifically are they worried about?
Two main areas. Resources and tech infrastructure. The U.S. wants to curb China's access to things like critical minerals, lithium, maybe even uranium supplies.
Strategic materials.
Right. And on the tech side, they're pushing Argentina to favor deals with U.S. companies, especially in telecom, to counter Huawei. Oh. Huawei already runs a 5G network there, which raises U.S. concerns about security, data, surveillance.
And China's involved in other big projects, too.
Yeah, they're financing a nuclear power plant, which is another point of friction.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, sounded pretty confident about this. He said Milei is committed to getting China out of Argentina.
He did say that publicly, but interestingly, President Milei himself pushed back almost immediately. He denied that claim, said his government would not be cutting ties with Beijing.
So conflicting messages there. Argentina needs the money, maybe from both sides.
It seems like Milei is trying to walk a tightrope. He needs the U.S. financial package, but probably can't afford to completely alienate China either. China, for its part, called the U.S. comments typical Cold War mentality.
So the U.S. aid might stabilize Argentina's economy for now, but the underlying geopolitical competition for influence and resources is still very much active.
Extremely active. Now, shifting over to Asia, Japan has just confirmed its first female prime minister, Sanae Takaichi.
She's known as a conservative, right?
Yeah.
Pro-U.S., more hawkish on China.
That's her reputation, yes. And she steps into the job facing immediate and intense pressure from Washington, specifically on defense spending.
What's the demand?
The Pentagon is pushing allies globally to increase defense spending to 5% of their GDP. 5%.
5% for Japan. That's huge. Where are they now?
Currently about 1.4% of GDP. They had already set a goal, considered quite ambitious for Japan, to reach 2% by 2028.
So the U.S. is asking for more than double Japan's own ambitious target.
Exactly. It's a massive leap, especially for a country with a pacifist constitution, historically.
And doesn't this come on top of other financial pressures from the U.S.?
It does. It follows that strained trade deal struck back in July. Remember, that deal put a 15% tariff on many Japanese imports, but required Tokyo to commit to investing $550 billion in the U.S. economy over the next few years to sort of offset it.
Wow. So Japan is being asked to pour $500 trillion into the U.S. and dramatically ramp up its own defense budget at the same time.
That's the situation. It puts Prime Minister Takaichi in an incredibly tight fiscal spot right out of the gate. Where does she find the trillions of yen needed for both the U.S. investments and this huge defense spending increase?
It feels like a coordinated effort to really reshape Japan's economic and strategic posture using financial leverage.
It certainly looks that way, a real masterclass in applying pressure to an ally to align them with U.S. strategic goals.
Okay, from these huge geopolitical maneuvers, let's turn to the Middle East. The ceasefire in Gaza. Still incredibly fragile, it seems.
Deeply fragile. The hostage situation remains incredibly painful and complex. Hamas just released the bodies of two more elderly Israeli hostages, Arya Zalmanovich and Tamir Edar.
That brings the total return to 15, I think, with 13 still held?
That's correct. It's a slow, agonizing process.
Yeah.
And the U.S. is heavily involved in trying to keep the truce from collapsing entirely.
VP J.D. Vance and Jared Kushner have been meeting with both sides.
Yes, delivering pretty stark warnings, especially to Israel, about avoiding escalation and keeping any responses to violations strictly proportional.
Vance had some interesting comments about the nature of this truce.
He did. He basically acknowledged how messy it is. He said something like, every time there's violence, people want to say the ceasefire's over. It's not. This is how it has to happen when you have groups with such deep hatred who've been fighting so long.
Acknowledging the grim reality that violations are almost inevitable, but the goal is to contain them.
Right. It's the only path forward, however imperfect. And behind the scenes, talks are apparently already starting on the really difficult stage two issues.
Like what happens after the fighting stops?
Exactly. Disarmament of Hamas, how Gaza will be governed post-war, who makes up the stabilization force needed on the ground. These are the huge, thorny questions.
And looming over all of this is the potential for wider regional deals. Saudi Arabia.
That's always the background hope. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is due at the White House in November. That visit could restart talks about Saudi-Israel normalization.
But the sticking point is still the same, isn't it? The Palestinians.
It is. Saudi Arabia apparently still requires a formal, credible commitment from Israel towards a Palestinian state. And that's something that Netanyahu's current government strongly opposes, especially after the trauma of October 7th.
So high-level diplomacy continues. But the human cost on the ground is just immense. The journal highlighted a specific family story.
Yes, and it's just heartbreaking. Gaida Quada, a 29-year-old farmer, her husband, Abdal Rahman Al-Shawaf, and their little daughter, Farah.
They've been displaced multiple times.
11 times. 11 times in the last 2 years alone, they've had to flee their home.
Incredible. And they had a project.
Yeah, Quada was involved in something called the Green Girls Project, trying to empower Palestinian women through sustainable farming. That was completely destroyed early in the war. They went back home to find their living room just rubble.
So where are they now?
Living in tents. They lack basics like mattresses, warm clothes as winter approaches.
And their daughter?
Farah. She's almost three. And she's clearly traumatized. The article mentions her constantly talking about a friend named Talia, who she believes was killed. She keeps saying, Mama, Talia is in heaven. Talia had a wound, shrapnel.
Oh, that's just devastating for a child.
It is. They're basically living with three packed backpacks and a stroller, ready to flee again for the 12th time. Just hoping the truce holds long enough for them to maybe start rebuilding somehow, even if it means living in a tent on their damaged land for months.
That personal story really underscores the human stakes behind all the geopolitical talk. Okay, let's bring it back home now. U.S. domestic politics and policy shifts.
We start with a pretty significant political flameout. Paul Ingrassia withdrew his nomination to head a White House ethics office.
This was because of those reported texts, right? Racist, anti-Semitic comments.
That's right. The reports detailed some really shocking stuff, calling Martin Luther King Jr. Day a holiday that should be ended and tossed into the seventh circle of hell, using an Italian racial slur, even saying, quote, I do have a Nazi streak in me from time to time.
His lawyer tried to defend them as satire.
Yeah, claimed he was trying to satirize liberals who call Maggier supporters Nazis. But that explanation didn't fly.
Especially not with Republicans in the Senate.
Exactly. Once three key GOP senators on the relevant committee, Lankford, Rick Scott, Ron Johnson, came out against him, the nomination was effectively dead.
It shows there's still some lines, even in today's politics, that can't be crossed for certain roles.
It seems so. The Journal's opinion section even framed it as a potent lesson for Maggie youth in what not to do. A sign that holding actual institutional power requires a different standard than just, you know, online rhetoric.
Okay, shifting to economic policy. The administration is tackling high beef prices.
Yeah, beef prices hit records last quarter. They're using a couple of tools here. First, releasing some frozen aid money.
Aid for farmers.
Over $3 billion from the Commodity Credit Corporation, the CCC. It's this old New Deal mechanism. The money was held up by the government shutdown, but releasing it now will help farmers, especially soybean growers, hit by China's tariffs from the trade war.
Okay, so direct aid, and then a plan specifically for beef supply.
Right. USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins outlined a plan to open up some new federal lands for cattle ranching. And maybe more significantly, they want to incentivize building smaller new beef processing plants.
Trying to break up the dominance of the big players like Tyson and JBS.
That's the stated goal. Secretary Rollins used the phrase onshore and reshore production. More competition ideally leads to lower prices down the line.
Interesting. Now, something that isn't getting administration support, or at least is facing pushback, the new H-1B visa fees.
Yeah, this is sparking some rare bipartisan agreement, but against the administration's policy. It's about the proposed $100,000 annual fee for new H-1B workers hired from outside the U.S.
$100,000 per worker per year.
That's the proposal. And Republicans like Jay Obernolte, Maria Salazar, Don Bacon are joining Democrats and saying it's just prohibitively expensive.
For whom? Big tech can probably afford that.
That's the point. Google, Microsoft. Maybe they can absorb it for a key engineer. But a small tech startup, a company in its early stages, paying $100 before the employee even starts working, it's crippling. It basically favors the established giants over the innovators.
An unintended consequence, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay, one more policy point. The IRS is easing up on reporting for a new tax deduction.
Yeah, a little bit of good news for some taxpayers. It's about that new $10,000 deduction on interest paid on auto loans.
But only for certain cars, right?
Right. Only for new vehicles where the final assembly was in the U.S. It's part of that whole Made in America push.
What's the issue?
The systems just aren't ready. The IRS basically admitted that neither they nor the lenders have updated their forms and processes yet. So for this first year, lenders won't face penalties if they don't issue the specific IRS form.
Meaning taxpayers can just use their regular loan statements.
Exactly. They can rely on their monthly or annual statements to claim the deduction when they file taxes next year. It makes it easier to access the benefit while everyone catches up on the paperwork.
Okay. Now, let's shift gears completely. From policy debates to high-stakes crime, the Louvre heist.
Yeah, this was pretty stunning. Thieves broke into the Louvre in Paris and snatched 8 pieces of jewelry, part of the French crown jewels, valued at around $102 million.
$100 million. That sounds like a sophisticated operation.
You'd think so, but the details emerging suggest it was surprisingly amateurish. Audacious, yes, but sloppy.
How so?
They left tools behind. Angle grinders, apparently a furniture lift they used to get through a window or case. That's not typical of top-tier professionals.
And did they drop something incredibly valuable?
This is the almost unbelievable part. They dropped the 1855 crown of Empress Eugenie, loaded with diamonds and emeralds outside the museum. Damaged. Just left it on the street.
Drop the crown jewels. Wow. That suggests maybe not the Pink Panthers this time.
Experts think probably not. That level of carelessness is unusual for highly organized groups. The big fear now is what happens to the pieces they did get away with.
Because they're historic, not easily fenced.
Exactly. Unlike modern gems, these older pieces don't have microscopic serial numbers lasered onto them, so the fear is they'll just be broken up.
Gems recut, gold melted down.
Precisely. They lose all their historical significance, their provenance, but they retain value just as raw materials. Gold is gold. Big diamonds are big diamonds. They become almost untraceable once dismantled.
And even if they sell them, the original thieves don't get the full $100 million.
Not even close. Experts estimate thieves rarely get more than 10% of the market value. They have to pay the organized crime networks that handle the smuggling, the recutting, the selling into the black market. It's a risky business with surprisingly low margins for the people taking the initial risk.
Fascinating underworld economics. Okay, from crimes involving immense wealth, let's look at some very different social dynamics and anxieties, starting with higher education.
Yeah, the rising cost of college has led to some interesting, maybe troubling models. High Point University in North Carolina is a prime example.
The journal calls it a magnet for rich kids. How does that work?
They very deliberately built their financial model around attracting students who can pay the full sticker price. And it's a hefty price tag, nearly $50,000 just for tuition and fees. Add room and board, it can easily top $90,000 a year.
$90,000 a year.
Yeah, and this strategy has fueled incredible campus expansion, but it changes who attends. They actually admit a high percentage of applicants, about 68%, so it's not super selective academically.
But they focus on ability to pay.
Clearly. The key indicator is their Pell Grant rate. Only 11% of their undergraduates receive Pell Grants, which are specifically for low-income students. That is extremely low compared to most universities. It's a direct signal of the affluence of the student body.
And the campus itself reflects this. Luxury amenities.
Oh, yeah. It sounds more like a resort. 6 heated outdoor pools, perfectly manicured gardens everywhere, classical music piped outdoors, a planetarium, mock courtrooms, high-tech labs. The president, Nido Kubien, runs it like a business, focusing on the total experience.
And part of that experience is teaching life skills.
This is the really unique and sometimes criticized part. They have mandatory activities focused on professional polish. This includes dining at fancy on-campus restaurants.
Like a steakhouse on the meal plan.
Exactly. They have 1924 Prime, a high-end steakhouse, and a Mediterranean grill. Students use their meal swipes there, but the servers are actually trained to coach them on etiquette.
Seriously. Like which fork to use?
Body language, professional dress, conversation skills, yes, even which fork to use. The rationale presented is that job interviews often happen over meals, so students need to be comfortable and polished in those nice environments.
They even have a mock airplane cabin.
For practicing in-flight networking, critics dismiss it as a glorified country club, but the university argues they're selling not just a degree, but access to an elite network and the social fluency needed to succeed in certain high-paying fields.
And they lock in these full-paying students early.
Over half their students apply through early decision, which is binding.
Meaning if you get in, you have to go, and you can't compare financial aid offers.
Precisely. It's a strong signal to the university that the family likely doesn't need financial aid, or at least isn't prioritizing comparing offers. It guarantees that tuition revenue up front. It's very effective financially, but raises obvious questions about equity and access.
A very different kind of educational model. Okay, let's move from the economics of education to something deeply personal. The autism diagnosis debate.
Yeah, this is a really sensitive and important conversation. The single-label autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, which became standard in 2013, there's growing debate about whether it's broad enough.
Because the experiences under that umbrella are just so vastly different.
Hugely different. Experts are saying the single label might actually do a disservice to all because it lumps together such diverse needs and abilities. There's a push for more specific categories again.
The journal article used a powerful personal example to illustrate this.
It did. Peyton Lockheed, she was diagnosed later in life at 29 with level 1 autism, what used to be called high functioning or Asperger's. She's married, has a job, lives a, quote, fairly normal life. She can analyze her own experience.
But her son?
Her 8-year-old son, Grayson, has level 3 autism, sometimes called profound autism. He's minimally verbal, has severe meltdowns that can last for hours, needs help with basic daily tasks like bathing and dressing, constant supervision.
And Peyton struggles with them having the same diagnosis.
Deeply. Because their daily realities, their needs, are just worlds apart. It feels wrong to her that they fall under the exact same label.
This is fueling the push to formally recognize profound autism as a distinct category.
Yes. There's a proposed definition out there. It generally includes needing round-the-clock care and supervision and either having an IQ below 50 or being nonverbal or minimally verbal.
What's the argument for creating this distinction?
Better resource allocation. That's a big part of it. Advocates argue that without a specific designation, the very significant needs of individuals with level 3 autism, who require extensive support, funding for care, specific research, get lost or diluted within the broader spectrum narrative, which is often dominated by higher functioning voices.
It's that tension, again, the complexity of human experience versus the need for workable categories in systems like healthcare and education.
Exactly. It's messy. As one expert said, human brain disorders don't always cut at neatly defined boundaries. But people like Peyton worry that the broad label might hold back progress for those with the most profound needs.
A really difficult balance. Okay, for our last deep dive into social dynamics, let's travel to China and look at these matchmaking corners.
Ah, yes, the Songjiangnao, the marriage market. It's quite a phenomenon. Every weekend, particularly in parks in cities like Chongqing, you see hundreds of parents, mostly retirees.
And what are they doing?
They're basically acting like human dating apps for their unmarried adult children, holding up signs, exchanging resumes.
Resumes for marriage. What's on them?
It's fascinating. Standard stuff like age, height, job, education, but also things that would be considered totally off limits or taboo on a Western dating profile.
Like what?
Exact weight, precise salary figures, and really importantly, whether the parents have pensions and good health insurance. They're laying out the whole family's financial picture.
It's very pragmatic. What's driving this? Why are parents taking such a direct role?
It's driven by some pretty intense demographic and cultural anxiety. China's marriage rate hit a record low last year. Just 6.1 million couples got married, which was down a staggering 21% from the year before.
21% drop in 1 year. Wow.
Yeah. And this feeds directly into concerns about the shrinking population, the aging workforce. It's all connected. Plus, you still have the lingering effects of the one-child policy, which created a gender imbalance more men than women, especially in certain age groups.
So parents feel this urgency to get their kids, especially sons maybe, married off.
There's definitely that pressure, but there's also a big generational disconnect happening.
Oh, so?
Many of the adult children, especially young women who are educated, maybe own property, have careers. They have higher expectations now. Like one woman quoted, 34-year-old Zhang Jing, she looked at the profiles her parents brought home and basically felt the available men aren't good enough.
Higher standards than the parents' generation.
Much higher. As one volunteer matchmaker put it, her generation married out of necessity for stability. Today's young people are asking, why should I settle? They want financial compatibility, sure, but also emotional connection, shared values, things that aren't easily listed on a resume in the park.
So do these markets actually work often? Do people find spouses there?
Success stories seem pretty rare, honestly, but the practice persists. It seems to serve more as a social ritual for the parents, a way for them to feel like they're doing something proactive, to manage their own anxiety about their children's futures and the continuation of the family line.
A very public display of private anxieties. Okay, let's wrap up with a few quick financial and world headlines.
That sounds good. Quick market check first.
Yeah, the Dow Jones actually ticked above 47,000 for the first time ever briefly on Tuesday, thanks to those strong earnings reports we discussed. It closed up about 0.5%.
But the NASDAQ, the tech index, was down slightly, about 0.2%.
And interestingly, gold and silver prices fell. Any reason given for that?
Analysts seem to think it reflects a bit more optimism about a potential U.S.-China trade deal, maybe easing tensions. So less demand for those traditional safe haven assets.
Okay. Meanwhile, trouble brewing in the U.K. government's finances.
Yeah, they overshot their borrowing target for the first half of the fiscal year by a decent amount. Borrowed almost $100 billion when they projected about $92.5 billion.
What does that mean practically?
It pretty much guarantees that the Treasury chief, Rachel Reeves, is going to have to announce more tax hikes or spending cuts or both in the upcoming November budget. Their debt level itself isn't totally out of whack compared to others, but servicing that debt is expensive because their inflation has remained stubbornly high, around 4%.
Higher borrowing costs biting them. And finally, an opinion piece praising trick-or-treating.
Yeah, a nice counterpoint to all the heavy news. The author argues Halloween trick-or-treating is actually a really important democratic ritual.
How so?
Calls it a rehearsal for citizenship. It builds social bravery, kids approaching strangers' doors. It builds neighborly trust, people opening their doors to those kids. It reinforces shared public space and simple civic virtue at a time when we're often very divided and distrustful.
A sweet thought about a simple tradition. Okay,
one.
So we've covered a lot today. From massive corporate scale and AI ambitions.
To geopolitical pressures, trade wars, fragile truces.
Right down to the anxieties playing out in universities, families dealing with diagnoses, and even parents trying to find spouses for their kids in a park.
It really loops back to that theme of scale, doesn't it? These huge systems, AI, global trade, media conglomerates are all driving towards bigger and bigger consolidation.
But as the systems try to get simpler and more monolithic, the individual human experience often seems to get more complex, more fractured.
That's a great way to put it. Think about the autism debate. The system wanted one simple label, but the lived reality is incredibly diverse and complex, pushing back against that simplification. Or the family in Gaza, just crushed by forces utterly beyond their control.
So for you, the learner, maybe the key takeaway today is that tension, the constant push-pull between the drive for massive scale and consolidation in our systems and the intricate, often messy complexity of individual human lives and needs.
Yeah, the world wants simplicity, but life resists it.
Let's end with a final provocative thought, maybe connecting back to that media consolidation and the value of content. We mentioned Comcast, NBCUniversal's parent, signing that huge $27 billion deal for NBA rights.
Right, even though they expect to lose over $1 billion a year on it initially.
Exactly. They see live sports as their content superpower, something indispensable worth losing money on in the short term for the long-term strategic value. They view it almost as a social necessity to keep their platforms relevant.
That's what's the question.
Well, if a massive corporation decides that sports entertainment is so essential that it justifies losing billions annually, what does that say about how we value actual social necessities? Things like reliable elder care, robust mental health support, maybe even functional childcare systems or basic infrastructure. If sports are worth that kind of massive loss-leading investment because they're seen as socially indispensable by media companies, shouldn't we be willing, as a society, to make similar large-scale investments in those other areas that are arguably even more fundamentally indispensable, regardless of whether they show an immediate financial profit?
That's a powerful question to ponder. What do we define as truly essential, and are we funding it accordingly?
Something to think about. Thank you for joining us for the deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025.
Until next time.